I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. My next guest is Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's the director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York City, an author of many books, and many people's favorite astrophysicist and science advocate. Good afternoon to you, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Thanks for having me on the show. You just call me Neil.
Okay.
The deGrasse, you know, great in the intro, but after that, it's just clumsy. You know?
Okay. Let's go for it, Neil. Let's talk about a few things that have been in the news. Get your thoughts. I know you have thoughts on all things in space.
All things cosmic, yes.
We've heard in our news, Neil, that NASA is angling to capture a small asteroid, drag it closer to Earth for human exploration. In fact, the Obama administration's proposed budget for 2014 includes $100 million to kick off this project. And I understand that under this new plan, there's a robotic craft will somehow snag a yet-to-be-selected asteroid in 2019, return it to the vicinity of the moon for a human spacewalk mission 2 years later. Explain why this is deemed such a worthy project. What we can get out of it?
Well, that's an excellent question, and the answer is different depending on what camp you're from. All right, so if you are in the sort of the manned space exploration camp, whether the word manned being sexist is in modern times just called crewed vehicles, I think that's more informative too, that you think of a space crew. If you're in that camp, you will say, oh, this is an occasion for humans to participate in a science activity. If you're a scientist and you're purely a scientist, you might say, well, why all the drama? Why not just go to an asteroid? We've been to them before, and just grab a rock off of one of them and bring it back and do that with a robot.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is that when space activities unfold in this government and most other places, it's a complex formula for what does it do for science, what does it do geopolitically, what does it do regionally, what does it do, and this mission sort of puts a little check in many boxes. You get to test what it is to move real estate around in the solar system. That's something we've never done before, something we wanted sort of know to be able to do the day we find an asteroid headed our way. And that recent explosion over Russia, the meteor over Russia, you can't get a better sort of shot across our bow than that. And we also know that the SLS, the Orion combination, which is the launch system to take humans into space, it now gives them a place to go to do something interesting. The reason why we're bringing the asteroid here, apart from just getting practice moving things, is that the launch system cannot reach the asteroid belt. The duration of time that it can stay away from Earth and the farthest distance it can reach can't get there. So we're going to move the asteroid to us robotically. So this is what's going on with that whole plan.
What would it be like to walk on an asteroid? It doesn't have an atmosphere. It doesn't have any gravity, does it?
Well, yeah, so it doesn't have an atmosphere, but you can be much larger and not have an atmosphere. I mean, the moon essentially doesn't have an atmosphere to speak of. And the asteroid that they consider dragging into the space of the moon is only, 5 to 10 meters across. So this is not the kind of asteroid you would stand on or walk around on. It's too small and the mass is too low. But if you went to a sort of a larger asteroid, there'd be a very mild gravitational field there. And you can imagine playing sports on such an asteroid that might be a few miles across. You could jump really high on these asteroids, and you might, in fact, be at risk of jumping yourself into orbit.
You mentioned the debate, man versus robotic exploration of the universe, and you said that you're in Iowa for the first time, in Iowa City. Of course, a longtime home of James Van Allen. He was very much against manned space exploration because there's just so much bang for your buck in robotic, non-manned exploration. Where do you stand on this?
Yeah, it's not a matter of where I stand. I try not to hand people opinions. What I try to do is offer perspectives. So my perspective on this, in the 55-year history of NASA, if you look at what fraction of the NASA's budget has been devoted to science, the average over all those years is about 25%. 75% of NASA's budget over the past 50 years has been given to the manned program, with or without regard to whether that manned program is accomplishing science. And so for a scientist to say NASA should not send humans into space, sure. So you take away the money that sends them into space, and that same scientist is thinking that that money is going to go to them, but that's not how this works. NASA was not invented to do science. It was invented in a Cold War climate. I say all this in my recent book, by the way, Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. The original title of that book was Failure to Launch, the Dreams and Delusions of Space Enthusiasts. But the publisher thought that was too depressing, and they said, we can't have the word failure in a title. But my point is, there are geopolitical reasons why the country would want to put people into space that have nothing to do with science and is not driven by science. And so to say, don't put humans in space, you don't control that money. It's not your money to think about as a scientist. So, like, shut up about it and use the. Be happy there's a NASA to begin with, and be happy that some fraction of the NASA money is going to science, and let's make the best of what that money is. That's really, but that's a very pragmatic assessment of what's actually happening there. And so, because there's scientists who think that astrophysicists who are sure that NASA is their private funding agency. And they just need a wake-up call, and I'm happy to do the slapping of them.
Okay.
I don't need the press for that. I can just go ahead and do that. And especially I'm of a generation where practically every one of my colleagues who would give that same argument, oh, let's not send people, let's just send robots, I say, well, how did you get interested in the universe? Oh, well, it was the Apollo program with
yes.
the astronauts walking on the moon. So for many, they're not being completely – they're being a little disingenuous about how they got excited versus how they think a subsequent generation should. But to Van Allen's point, it is true that if your only goal in space is science, then you would never send people. Because for every human you send in space, you can send, you know, 100 robots, right? So, mm-hmm. And the robot, you don't even have to bring the robots back home. You barely have to feed them, a few solar panels, and that's it. So the return, the scientific return, is far greater by robots than by people. But that's not the primary driver of why anyone's ever gone into space.
Back in 2010, President Obama announced his intention to send human explorers to this near-Earth asteroid by 2025, then also mentioning Mars perhaps sometime in the 2030s. When we talk about humans on Mars, I'm reminded of a science fiction book perhaps you read. I read in my teens a man called, I think it was called Man Plus, a man created to live on Mars, his skin replaced, his ears were giant solar collectors.
Cool story.
Yeah.
No, I don't know that story, but that's really cool, yeah.
It's called Man Plus. I'm not recalling the author right now. But why would we go to Mars then?
Well, There are two ways to think about that. One of them is you genetically engineer a human that could do just fine on Mars, you know, breathe the carbon dioxide or whatever. Another way is you terraform Mars. Instead of converting us to it, you convert it to us. And terraform is one of my, you know, favorite word of the past couple of decades, where, you know, you take the surface of an otherwise inhospitable planet, inhospitable to life as we know it, and seed it in some particular way that starts organisms growing, that and the byproduct of the growing organisms is oxygen, and then you put some water vapor there, and you get clouds, and you get rain, and then lakes form, and so you terraform, and that way you make it livable for us, and then we can become a two-planet species instead of a one-planet species. I don't think it's realistic to imagine that we would live on Mars permanently if you always had to have on a spacesuit, or if you could only live in some kind of hab module. I don't see the point. I don't see the attraction of that other than as a vacation jaunt.
Okay. Neil deGrasse Tyson is my guest, if you've just joined us, director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York City. Let's talk for a few minutes before we have to say goodbye to, about privatization. NASA has changed its strategy to encourage commercial space development. This has resulted in, we've heard in our news, successful launches by this company, SpaceX, also the formation of an increasing number of commercial space development firms. I wonder, give us a picture of how you think space will be shaped by commercial development, privatization in the future.
Well, first of all, this should have been happening decades ago. And in fact, in the 1980s, the NASA charter was amended to include language that would promote and stimulate the private enterprise to be a major part of NASA's missions going forward. Now, in all fairness to NASA, NASA has always engaged the creativity of private enterprise. For just as an example, the LEM, the vehicle that landed on the moon, was designed and built in Bethpage, New York, Long Island, at the Grumman factory, and a center where they supported the NASA's Apollo missions. And so NASA has always contracted large and important pieces of its operation. The difference is no one organization would have the responsibility for taking astronauts anywhere or serving crew needs, supply needs for astronauts. That was always a NASA vehicle. And NASA shouldn't have to do that, right? I mean, the blunt way to think of the space shuttle was that it was a cargo vessel. And do we need NASA to be driving cargo vessels with our best and brightest and finest astronauts? So I always felt that once we do something routine, you farm it off to private enterprise, who can surely do it more efficiently, and then that leaves NASA in the business of advancing the frontier, which is what they're chartered to do. So, like I said, this should have been happening a long time ago. What people think will happen, but every read that I have of human conduct tells me it won't, is that private enterprise will then lead the space frontier. But I think that simply won't happen. It can't happen because the space frontier is expensive, it's dangerous, and there are unquantified risks. And if you combine all three of those, you cannot create a capital market valuation of the frontier. And therefore, there's no business model for it. Mm. Governments are the first to do these things. Then they map the trade winds and find out where the hostiles are, and can you survive there? This is all information fed to private enterprise, and then they find cheap and easy ways to do it. So I see it as a very fertile relationship going forward, just as was portrayed in the film 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Right.
The space shuttle was Pan Am. There was Howard Johnson's hotel in the space station. AT&T carried the phone signals. So that view, I think, is not unrealistic.
they didn't pick the best companies for the future. The best guess is Howard Johnson's and Pan Am, did they? With that being said, if you had to guess right now, who, any commercial names out there in space development that will be likely you'd put your money on being the Apple or the McDonald's of space development?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't put my money on it. But if I were to say, well, what's coming down the pipe? You may have remembered in recent news cycles, there were two companies announced, different companies, to exploit the resources on asteroids.
Yes.
And I think if far enough in the future, those folks will be the first trillionaires. And, not all industries in one decade are the leading industries of decades to follow. And just look at U.S. Steel, for example. Couldn't have gotten any more blue chip than that. And now, who even knows what that is anymore? And so there were eras where steel was big, and now it's not anymore. There was eras where railroads were big, and they're not anymore. So I'm not going to pick a company today and say that's going to be the big company tomorrow. The company that will make the first trillionaires tomorrow perhaps has not yet been founded. Because the needs and the urges and the sources of wealth will be nothing like anything anyone is exploiting today.
We've had several times on this program a really fascinating Iowa State University professor of physics and astronomy. You know him, Steve Kowaler. He's associated with NASA's Kepler mission, launched back in 2009, the first attempt to look for Earth-like planets in our part of the Milky Way. We've been hearing a lot of really interesting things from Kepler. What excites you most about Kepler's recent findings of the estimated number of, well, Earth-like planets or possible Earth-like planets.
Yeah, and just back up for a moment. Steve Kowaler, yes, he's a very good friend of mine. We were in graduate school together. And if you comb the internet, you might find a black and white photo of the two of us standing there. And there's a fellow other graduate student, a woman, and the three of us there, it looks like the Mod Squad. So he and I are pictured there together. So he's been in Iowa almost his whole professional career. And so I may get a chance to see him on this trip. But yes, so the Kepler mission, designed to find sort of Earth-like planets around Sun-like stars, but the great excitement for me there, apart from the sheer numbers of planets that have been reported, that number's about to pass 1,000, by the way. And the first of these planets was announced in 1995, right? And so think about it. We went from no known planets outside of the solar system to more than 1,000 in just a couple of decades. So it's a testament to the advance of technology and clever ways that people come up with for detecting these things. So what I like is we make a catalog of what kinds of planets there are out there, and then you could rank them in order where you might want to send signals if you think it might have intelligent life. But another interesting phenomenon is if it has life, it's probably not what we think of as intelligent. It might be microbial, some kind of plant life, some simple forms of life. If there is such life, it will leave what we call a biomarker signature in the atmosphere. And so using very careful spectrographic measurements, you can find the chemical composition of the atmosphere of these planets. And if the atmosphere, so the atmosphere can betray the existence of active life functioning on that planet's surface. And if that atmosphere contains things like smog, well, then you're sure the life is what we call intelligent.
But if it's 50,000 light years away from us, might it just as well not exist, because we can't reach them, can we?
Yeah, well, 50,000 light years is farther away than what Kepler is really observing for this mission. So these are much closer. But second, yes, they're still kind of hopelessly far away to visit. Currently, our fastest spaceships that don't even carry people but carry lifeless lumps of hardware, if you hitched a ride on one of these craft, it would take you 50,000 years to get to the nearest star to the sun. And that's just, you know, the first rule in science is you want your experiment to be finished before you die, right? So we have no known or foreseeable way to visit any of these planets. And so you rely on radio waves, radio signals, and light beams, and this sort of thing, which travels at the speed of light. And even so, it takes many, many years for that signal to reach it.
Here's a question related to what you just said, sent in by a listener. If your car could go the speed of light, would your headlights still work?
Well, material objects, based on our knowledge of the universe, cannot go at the speed of light, but we can make it very close. Let's say 99.9999999% the speed of light. So you're damn near at the speed of light. If you put on your headlights, you would see your headlights go straight ahead. You would not know you're going that fast. This is one of the important tenets of Einstein's relativity. As far as you're concerned, everybody else is moving that fast by you. People had a hard time accepting this when Einstein first came out with it in 1916. And there was a news article that parodied it and said, "Hey, Einstein, what time does Grand Central Terminal arrive at the next train?" So it takes some getting used to. But you put on the headlights, you just keep driving.
Last year, you released your 10th book. You mentioned that, Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. Currently, though, you're working on a 21st century reboot of Carl Sagan's landmark television series, Cosmos. What can we expect from the new Cosmos series? How will your approach be different or the same? How will it compare to Carl Sagan's?
First, it's an honor to even be in that spot, right? I mean, I'm host and narrator. We have on this project Anne Druyan, who is one of the original creative principals from that series with Carl Sagan. So she's the writer of record for the scenes and how the show will unfold. So she knows very well, as do we all, but she's like genetically linked to that of Cosmos that made it so special to the viewer. And this is what we're carrying forward into this next series, except there are other stories to tell, there are new ways to tell these stories, and the mission statement here is not simply to tell you what science exists out there, but to convey to you why that matters, and why science as a way of knowing is fundamental to our health, our safety, our security, our well-being, and it will matter to the future of nations and of the world.
Okay. Thank you very much, Neil deGrasse Tyson, for being with us. We'll go out, in fact, with a little bit of Carl Sagan, that voice we all know so well, in inspiring us to take our minds outside of the solar system into the universe, as you do as well. Director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York City, author, and our favorite astrophysicist and science advocate, Neil deGrasse Tyson, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me.
All my life, I've wondered about life beyond the Earth. On those countless other planets that we think circle other suns, is there also life?
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available by going to our website, iowapublicradio.org. And you can contact us anytime with your comments and questions. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Once again, that's River to River at iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.